Hi, this is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon, and my guest today is the blog's official wine marketing expert, Paul Tinknell of Tinknell and Tinknell in Napa. Paul, thank you so much for doing this again, and this is quite possibly the greatest podcast ever in the history of podcasts, yes?
Always, absolutely.
Well, and especially because you're going to solve the wine business's marketing problems in the next 15 minutes, correct?
That is correct. All that we need is everybody to listen to me.
Because for those of you listening, Paul and I have, we talk about this. We send emails about this. We text about it, except I'm just a terrible texter. And you've got kids, so you're texting them. But yeah. We talk about this all the time, about why only cranky old ex-sports writers like me are trying to solve the wine business's problems. So I said to Paul, let's do a podcast. And Paul, you'll solve the wine business's problem. So that's what we're going to do for the next 10, 12, 15 minutes. And basically it comes down to every single bit of bad news that we've seen over the last 18 months about the wine business, declining consumption, particularly among younger consumers. That wasn't supposed to happen, right? As soon as they got to their peak earning years. And for those of you who can't see this, I'm making quotation marks. They were supposed to start buying wine. They're not. Abstinence is a big deal. Demand is down. Consumption is down. The industry said, no, we don't want to try to do a joint marketing program. So in order to solve all their problems, Paul Tinknell, Tinknell and Tinknell in Napa, Paul, what can we do to save wine from itself?
Well, you know, the question becomes, why isn't the industry reacting to this essentially crisis in sales? And, you know, as we see consumption declining, we are just now beginning to see prices softening a little bit in reaction to declining sales. But, you know, that it's not a situation we can buy our way out of in terms of dropping prices, though prices do need to come down somewhat. So the question is, again, why isn't the industry doing something about this? Why did they abandon this idea of a cooperative marketing effort like we've done in the past? And, you know, it boils down to the fact that the wine industry has two major problems in trying to market itself. One, which is the fact that it's not really a cohesive industry. We're a bunch of small to global conglomerates, small family businesses to global conglomerates that just don't see eye to eye on 90% of the issues. And part of that is that, you know, the global conglomerates can take care of themselves. They have been, they will be doing so. And the other 4% of the small wineries don't have the economic clout to do anything together. Nor do they, again, share the vision to do anything together. There's no umbrella organization that represents them in that way.
Let me interrupt you there just one second. We discussed this before. I promise not to interrupt too much and talk too much, because I really think you've got some smart things to say. It strikes me that there's almost that 94%, 95% that aren't the 100 biggest wineries in the United States or the world or whatever they are. And it's almost as if I don't want anybody's help.
Right, right. When you're dealing with most of the wine businesses, and there are exceptions and some high profile ones, but most of the wine businesses are satisfied with the business that they have. You know, they always want to grow sales or raise prices a little bit or something like that. But underlying that, unless they're in some form of economic distress, is the fact that, hey, we're selling our wine. What's the problem? We don't see the problem. We've got our wine club. We've got our tasting room. We're doing just fine. And the big boys, of course, control most of the market share, and they also control most of the distribution. They're in the cat seat. They don't need to make a change at this point in time either. So it's really kind of frustrating because, you know, we're essentially, arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic while the band plays on and we're enjoying the music. So, hey,
it's like nobody sees the iceberg.
Yeah, don't stop the screaming in the background. I want to listen to the band, you know?
Very good.
And somebody scraped the ice off the deck, you know? So it's, you know, the industry has never been a cohesive industry. Unlike, you know, and interestingly enough, one could now point at beer and spirits, who are sharing the same problem as we are, and saying, hey, you know, aren't they somewhat the same? But the big beer companies, when they are advertising and pushing their beverages, it does have a ripple effect on the market. You know, and likewise, spirits, kind of anybody's efforts floats everybody's boats. And they also spend a lot more money than the wine industry does, a lot, by a factor of 10 to get to the beer level and another factor of 10 to get to the spirits level. So the wine industry is just not spending money on marketing.
And that's, I've always been baffled by that. And I won't mention any names, but the biggest wine companies in the world are as big, if not bigger, than the biggest beer and spirits companies. And I think, so I'm trying to figure out why they don't believe in marketing.
You know, it, so I think one of the reasons is, and if we look at this as a global trend, then does keep, it is still a question. But if you look at it as an American problem, then the American regulatory system acts like the, you know, our society is still stuck in prohibition times and treats alcohol like that. And regulations are set up to regulate a market back in 1933. It's not set up to regulate a market in 2022. So it's a, it is a barrier for people to do things in a cooperative way and for making big effects. And the big boys like the system currently because even though it treats this market in an archaic way, it favors them. So, you know, when you're a big wine distributor with multi, you know, national distribution, or you're a big winery that has, you know, global distribution, why rock the boat? I'm not going to create an opening for the other 94% to succeed when that would just mean that people would stop drinking my wine and switch to other people's wines. Most people in the wine industry look at it as a zero-sum game. And that's kind of a strange attitude. But, you know, unless you're the small guy in a regional area and you can feel the network effects happening in a region, we don't feel it nationally. It's not all, you know, all boats rise with the same tide type thing. Somebody always comes out on top.
No, it's interesting. It's interesting you mentioned the power of the biggest companies. I don't even know if power is the correct word. Perhaps it's the attitude of the biggest companies. I was working on a piece about a huge national brand, and I was talking to a retailer who swore that I couldn't, you know, use any, I couldn't say who had said it or even pretend that I knew who it was, because what the person told me was just so, I mean, revealing, which is most retailers, and particularly the ones that aren't, the supermarkets that aren't Costco, hate having to sell the most popular wines.
Yeah.
Because they don't make any money on it, because they basically, because of competition, and they're competing with themselves, because of competition, their margins are non-existent. But if they don't have these wines, their customers will be unhappy.
Right.
And what this person told me, and I said, come on now, you're not being serious. And this person said, no, this is all absolutely true. If you talk to any large retailer that's not a national chain, they will all tell you the same thing. They are forced to carry these brands because otherwise they got to go put end caps out on these brands, or the distributor will be mad at them, the producer will be mad at them, and they're stuck. And I thought, well, yeah, that's kind of our problem then.
That is our problem, is that we have slowly developed over the last 20 years a market that is furiously consolidating. And you know, we see the response to the current economic troubles and maybe downturn as, well, I don't need to grow the market. I'll just buy more market. You know, I will go out and buy my competitors and I got more market share then. I don't care about the fact that the pie is shrinking if I just get more and more of the pie. And you know, both the big distributors and the big producers are in that mindset at this point in time.
No, and
And
it's no, you're and it's just it baffles me. But I guess we're back to seeing and making maybe the band will take requests.
yeah, maybe so. Well,
Okay.
you know, the other thing I think you brought this up in a previous conversation is that when it comes to something like the wine rant proposal, which is let's go out and you know create a got wine type campaign, that the product doesn't lend itself to that kind of messaging. It, you know, we can go out and find wine on the shelf from a few dollars to, you know, auction houses that are selling them for a few hundred thousands of dollars. This is not meat or pork or milk where the price discrepancies fluctuate based on, you know, national, you know, marketplaces. We are again, this disparate group of people producing whatever we can and pricing it at every price point under the sun. So how do you go out and tell somebody to, let's buy wine tonight for dinner and on this, you know, whatever type of ad and tell the and have that make an effect because they'll go running into the store to buy the wine and go, well, do I buy the $40 bottle or do I buy the $4 bottle? I don't know. So we keep trying to emulate these other industries as if we are a cooperative industry, which we're not. Trying to sell a product which is not, you know, is the most heavily regulated consumer packaged goods in America, with the biggest and widest price discrepancy in America, and we fail because of that in trying to do that. And it is it that that's because we're taking the wrong tact. It's just that simple. We're telling people to go out and buy wine. We're not teaching people how to drink wine. Or to drink alcoholic beverages, you know, we have always treated wine and beer and spirits as a celebratory beverage, and we don't teach it as a cultural beverage. So our messaging is always, oh, game day, buy beer and drink. Special occasion, run out and get a bottle of wine. TGIF, head to the bar and get some cocktails. We don't say, hey, you having chicken for dinner? Here's some options. And we don't teach people how to drink and approach an alcoholic beverage as part of their lifestyle on an ongoing basis, only as a celebratory beverage.
That is brilliant, if I may say so. You can say thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think
And
it's kind of
I'll
obvious, but it's
no,
you know.
and I'll tell you why I think it's brilliant and why, even though it may be obvious, I get all the time wine releases, news releases with recipes.
Yeah,
And the recipes are the stupidest, dumbest, most complicated.
yes.
Yes, I live in tech. I live in Dallas, and it's August. Where the hell am I going to get bay scallops to have with his $35 white wine?
Wine. Yes. Yeah.
Or my favorite, for some bizarre reason, because I watch a lot of cooking shows because I like to cook. My new favorite is fennel. Everyone is on in the last year or so has decided that fennel is the new ingredient that everybody has to use, and I'm going, where am I going to find fennel? There's a huge big thing of fennel at the Kroger, right? It's cost $12.
Well, I got a field full of it if you wanted me to say so.
But that goes to your exact point. They don't
Yes.
see the wine consumer is it's not part of the culture. It's part of the celebratory, because I'm going to go find my Bay Sea scallops and pay $25 a pound or whatever. I'm
Yeah.
going to go to the Whole Foods or to the Trader Joe's or the natural grocer and go find some fennel that was raised by, you know, liberal arts graduates who yes. picked everything, you know, and then sang to it. and then I'm going to have all of my friends over of a certain demographic, and we're all going to have this wine with this, you know, fennel thing.
Yes.
And yeah. instead of just saying, hey, go put some damn sheet pan chicken in the oven and go get a bottle of white wine.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'm having a burger tonight. Great. Crack a beer and enjoy the beer with it. You know, you don't have to be making it a celebration. And I think you and I, and there's a very small, hardcore group of consumers that do treat alcohol as an optional beverage for socializing in a casual way or eating in a casual way. And, you know, that's what we need to teach people is, and that will expand consumption, that will bring in new customers because it breaks down the barriers and it doesn't encourage overconsumption. Because again, whenever we talk about a celebratory type of event, we're celebrating and there's supposed to be a breakdown of inhibitions to some degree, where we're relaxing and enjoying and possibly, you know, trying to get into a festive mood. And that, you know, can have the negative effect of encouraging overconsumption. And so this type of approach to the marketplace deals with the health issues and the movement towards healthy living that we see happening in our society. And it also expands the consumer base and grows the market.
Well, that was easy enough. What did this take us? 19 minutes, 20 minutes? No, and you're right. It's an incredibly complex explanation for what the problem is. But it goes back, and I'll tell you again why I think you're right. I did this big piece a couple of years ago and talked about the history of wine consumption in the U.S. Since basically, you know, 1776 alcohol consumption. And one of the things that they told me, the wine boom, in the late 70s and early 80s, it had a lot to do with the French paradox and it was healthy, quote marks again. But one of the things was pointed out was that's when cooking took off. That's when people yes. suddenly stopped cooking with a can of cream of mushroom soup right. and canned green beans.
Right.
And they made wine a part of the culture, their culture food, as opposed to just having a glass of sparkling wine on an anniversary. And again, I think while you're on the right track, the groups that kept wine going throughout all the dark times were cultural groups, were the immigrants who brought it over from Europe, the Italians.
Right.
The lesser extent, the Germans.
Right.
And that's as we all know, there's a reason there's a California wine business is because the Italians kept making wine during Prohibition in California.
The Italians and the Spanish, yes. And, you know, I you're 100% right that movement in the 80s of adopting cooking as a everyday expression of an enjoyment of relaxation and whatnot. For some reason, yes, wine floated up on that tide, but we didn't, and we tried. I mean, I will say the industry tried. We talked about food wines. Again, I'm using air quotes like you, because I think pretty much every wine can be a food wine in some situation. But, you know, we pushed that hard, and it did work to some extent. You know, I think that's why you might have a daily alcoholic beverage. That's why I have a nearly daily alcoholic beverage is because we took those cultural cues to heart and said, yes, I'm sitting down and I'm having my paprika chicken and this beautiful, lovely Chardonnay from Washington, and they taste good together. And I'm here with my lovely wife, and that's all that I need at this moment. I don't need to invite 15 friends over and you know, realize that my $15 Chardonnay may be inadequate, so I better run out and buy, a $50 Chardonnay instead. That's how we need to convey it in a much more simplified and less fussy way. Because you're right, the silly recipes that we send out as an industry, I always say, disappear into a desk drawer or the round file and just get totally ignored because nobody has the time to spend, 4 hours preparing this meal. And spending a week sourcing the ingredients. So,
That's the best part, the week sourcing the ingredients. Oh, yeah.
yeah.
Oh, yeah. All
It
right.
doesn't,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
well, I was going to say, I mean, there are other things the industry can do, and they're always in the background. And this is where we should be organizing as a collective rather than throwing money at advertising. And that's, as we've talked about, let's put ingredients on the labels. Let's, develop and promote eco-friendly practices throughout our businesses. Let's, promote better diversity. Let's promote local regional wineries better. These things also have huge effects on expanding the market. If we're more inclusive and we can break down some of these barriers that we self-impose and that are imposed on us, then we'll expand the marketplace too. And that what we is what we could be doing collectively behind the scenes.
Well, good. We did it. Solved it. Now,
Yeah,
hopefully, I'll put this up. I'll put this up on the blog. It'll go out. People will read it, and we're home. We're halfway
they
home.
can start sending us the checks for our smarts.
Hey, man, I'm going to tell you something. I love wine so much. You don't even have to send me a check. Just acknowledge, somewhere that you and I had this podcast, Paul, and I'll be happy, right? Hey,
Me
listen.
too.
Hey,
Me
listen.
too.
Thanks again. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this
It's
and
always
putting up
great to
again with
talk.
my foolishness.
No, it's always great to talk. I enjoy it tremendously. So I appreciate you having me on.
Right. Well, thanks again, Paul. This is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon. Thanks again for listening, and so long until next time.